And then people are charmed or frightened, but also very confused as to why this badger is so terrifying or alluring.
I mean, it's obvious why he's so terrifying.
And alluring.
Perhaps not alluring. It's obvious why he's so terrifying. He's a badger.
Look at my fine stripes. These sharp claws.
Live from the Mundangerous Killbox in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 291 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're starting a new series on combat tactics as we discuss focusing fire. But first, the party uncovers a scheme in the Gates of Morning campaign. And later, Fire in the Hole goes to ground in the Character Creation Forge.
All right, before we get started, just a reminder, we are still doing bonus content. Right after this episode, we will be recording that. It is our plot hook of the week. The first two episodes are on Patreon, and you can check it out there at any level. You will receive that content.
Let us know what you think, if you want more of them, or you want us to try something different. We are open to suggestions.
All right, Ishan, where are we in the Gates of Morning campaign?
So the Gates of Morning campaign is our 5th edition D&D game set in Eberron, a sequel of sorts to the original Morningglory campaign. And in Flamekeep, the seat of the Church of the Silver Flame, the party is hunting down a rogue sect of House Jurasco. So Switch the Paladin has decided to trust to chance, or more specifically, the Traveler, the god of change and creation that she secretly worships. After closing her eyes, her hand alights on the spine of a book. But when she opens her eyes, the book is being held by a smiling old man in flamic livery, who greets her as, "My child." His manner is much lighter than a typical follower of the Silver Flame, and he seems almost delighted by Switch's devotion to the principle of change, which, of course, she is more than happy to explain at length.
None of her philosophical musings appear to surprise him. Though she is in human form, he warns her that in the future she may meet some of her siblings who are less devoted to change. He asks that she try to help him.
When Switch tries to help people, sometimes they get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Just then, she turns when she hears Warden walk into the room looking for her. But when she turns back, the man is gone. Warden, though, saw no one but Switch. And Egan insists that this section of the stacks actually has no librarian.
The party regroups, and it seems that Jayla Darren has told Egan a lot about their task. He begins to pry information out of the party, explaining that he was an inquisitive, detective, before he was called to the church. And when the party explains they've been carrying around the corpse of Elaine, the Mindseed, after killing him in Korth, he reluctantly commends them for being practical. After all, this way, they can question the corpse using Speak with Dead once every 10 days, which surely they've been doing, right?
Right? Right? I'm pretty sure at this point you'd have the corpse for like, I don't know, 2 weeks.
But we hadn't had the spell for that long.
Yeah, that's true. Nor had you gone looking for someone who could cast it. That's very true. He does, however, offer to cast the spell right now.
So after a quick conference...
A long conference. It was like half a session.
A quick conference. The party agrees on 5 questions. First, they ask, what bodies are mind seeds and who are they now?
That's kind of 2 questions, but, you know, whatever. So the corpse's mouth opens and a breathy, disembodied voice issues forth. I do not know who they may be now, but we were Pol, Elaine, Gersi, Johara, Meryl, Voreg, Naleth, and Torn.
The last 3 names are new, though, you know, party just assumes they're likely the sellswords that escaped with the refugees on the Day of Morn.
Yeah, 2 of them anyway. Lenore then breathes a heavy sigh. She says Torn was the woman who was traveling with her on that day, the one that she called Mother, which a lot of you had picked up was probably a code word of some kind, because she was actually an important prisoner of House Thrashk, and Lenore was tasked with transporting her to the prison at Dreadhold when they were all killed. And of course she assumed Torn was killed and her duty fulfilled.
Next question. Why were you trying to break into the Tower of the Twelve?
And the voice comes again. To build a Hanbalan. Vesakad, the Kalishjar, is freaked out a bit by this because he knows that the Hanbalani Altas are the giant monoliths that dot the nation of Riedra and help the quarry control the minds of the populace. The Dreaming Dark, it appears, wants to do the same thing to the Dragonmarked houses.
Bramble then asks, why were we cut apart?
This time a different voice comes out of the body. A louder, frantic one emanates from the mouth. We were raised from the dead and cut apart, killed and raised again over and over. They wanted to see how we had been changed, what our limits were. And the voice describes an ordeal similar to the dreams that some of the party has been having about what they went through. The voice then changes to the breathy one more time. The bodies were infused with energies from two planes, Maybar and Dulur. It was the answer to our gravest problem.
And the party all groans because even the corpse makes dad jokes.
This is Elaine. He was literally dead.
The next question. What is your biggest problem?
How to bend the gates of the Dalkeer to stop the turning of the age. Well, putting all of their heads together, the party figures out that the gates of the Dalkeer probably means the dimensional seals placed by the gatekeeper druids thousands of years ago to keep the realm of madness, Zoriat, locked in place in its orbit around Eberron and preventing foul creatures from crossing the planar boundary. Good thing he had a druid and a greensinger bard in the party who knew a little bit about this stuff.
Vesakad guesses that the quarry want to repurpose the seals to lock Dalkor, the Plane of Dreams, in place of Zoriat, the Realm of Madness, perhaps preventing it from completing its natural revolution and cementing the control of Elashtavar, the Dreaming Dark, forever.
In effect, this would not only defeat the Kalishjar and let the quarry turn all of their attention to conquering Eberron, it would also unleash aberrations from Zoriat onto Corvair, just like would have happened thousands of years ago had the gatekeepers not stopped them.
So, beginning for the first time to see the magnitude of the stakes, the party tries to find a way to identify their enemies. With their last question, they ask, how do the Mind Seeds identify each other?
We are all, and have always been, Vakri. Vesakad doesn't know this name, but he recognizes it as a female quarry name, with no appellation that would signify a human host. And only then does the party realize that all of the Mind Seeds that they have been searching for have been seeded by a single quarry.
And we'll find out what happens next week.
So this week, new series!
For nearly 300 episodes now, we've been breezing through RPG mechanics and assessing their tactical value. And sometimes our dear listeners ask us, WTF are we talking about?
Could you go into a little more depth, maybe? And for 300 episodes, we have said no.
Yeah, and this is, you know, this is us creating a new series to discuss the tactics that we use most often at our table. Just about any game, though, you know, D&D is tactical enough that most of them apply to D&D, as a way to understand sort of what we think about when we assume like the power level of an ability, or we assume there are certain ways that parties are going to play. You know, when we're looking at those kind of tactical elements of games, when we're trying to solve the tactics of a game, what are the kind of levers that we're pulling at? What are the things that we're measuring? How are we thinking about the value of those abilities?
Right. Like, we talk a lot about the optimal way to build a character, but there are also often optimal ways to play a character, to make particular decisions during your turn and as a party. Now, if you're a lifelong power gamer, this might not be anything new. It certainly won't be anything groundbreaking, but it certainly is worth covering a lot of the basic tactics that we assume a party is using when we evaluate how strong a particular option is.
And then this series is not just for players. So we'll talk about how GMs can plan for these tactics in their combat encounters, how they can or sometimes should or should not use them against the players. So GMs can improve their game too, right? So you know how to play your monsters better.
Mm-hmm. And for you storytellers out there, we're also going to talk about how to incorporate these tactics into the story and the lore in ways that make sense, whether that is players using it or the monsters.
All right, so let's jump into it, Ishan. Focus Fire, what is it?
It's geeking the mage. The simplest version of this is when everyone on one side focuses all of their attacks and abilities on a single target to kill it as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and then I think the more complicated version of that is when everyone targets their attacks and abilities on common targets to ensure they're eliminated efficiently. So it's not necessarily that you need to kill something, it's that you need to take it out of the fight. It's not necessarily that everybody focuses the same target, it's that you efficiently focus targets so that, you know, two people kill this thing, three people kill that thing, and at the end of the turn, you've eliminated the most combatants possible.
Yeah, this is why, for example, we often talk about abilities like in 5e D&D, the spell Hypnotic Pattern as being extremely powerful, maybe even overpowered, because it allows you to selectively focus fire, right? If you can take all of the enemies in a given area and incapacitate all of them, then you can completely ignore the rest of them and everyone can walk up, focus fire, and take out each individual person one at a time.
Or the opposite, which is CC them and then focus somebody who isn't CC'd so that nobody gets to do anything on the enemy side, right?
Right. Given the topic of this particular series in this episode, do you want to explain CC?
Yeah, sure. So CC is crowd control. So that's just basically any ability which impacts an enemy's ability to choose, right? So if it restricts their movement, if it restricts their action economy, if they are stunned, if they are incapacitated, if they are knocked on their back or pushed around, right? Those are all effects that eliminate their or reduce their agency. And if you apply them in the right way, it reduces their agency in a way that forces them to, you know, attack somebody they don't want to, or lose a turn, or otherwise not be able to apply best tactics.
All right. So why is it that focus firing works so well? Why is it a common, useful tactic?
Okay, Ishan, I want you to take a little journey with me, because it's not every day that we get to go digging through the library and pull out the official guide to Command and Conquer from Brady Games.
Ooh, I feel like this should be an entire episode, but okay, I'm on board. Let's do this.
Okay, so Command and Conquer, old OG, frankly, real-time strategy. We're talking about the original game, which I got as a, I don't know, elementary schooler, middle schooler, right? It could barely run on my parents' computer. It came with this book. It was the guide to how you beat every mission in the campaign of Command and Conquer, right? But at the beginning, it had an introduction to basic tactics. And so this example has stuck with me for a very long time, okay? Imagine you have a scenario where you have five characters per side. They all have five hit points, and they deal one damage per round. So you have a smart team and a dumb team. The smart team is focusing fire on one target every round. The dumb team is spreading their aim out. Just, you know, everyone shoots someone different. So if you do this, right, play one round. The smart team has five wounded teammates. The dumb team has lost a team member. If you repeat that the second round, then five more damage have gone into a single target on the dumb team. And four damage has come back to the smart team, and they're all still standing. Right. If you keep repeating this, eventually the dumb team is dead and the smart team has only lost one casualty. So focus fire. Right. The mission here is like when you're picking units, right, send all your units to attack the same thing and then attack the next thing. Right. It works in RTS. It works in RPGs. It is just the sound thing. And the reason for that is, of course, like dead things don't fight back.
Right.
Right. So you don't get to act if you're dead. So make things dead. Don't make things injured.
Right. Ultimately, in the end, like in the final analysis, this is an action economy issue. What you're trying to do is eliminate the other team's turns. And in most combat games, the way to do that is to kill the enemy. So the thing you want to race toward as quickly as possible is killing an enemy, and the fastest way to do that is for everyone to jump on the same target, usually.
Right. Yeah. So this is obviously a stylized example. So wait, one
we've
thing
made a whole bunch of very important assumptions in this scenario.
Exactly. The most obvious one is that characters at one hit point are just as effective as they are at five hit points.
Which sounds dumb, but is extraordinarily common in RPGs.
Yeah, that's how D&D works.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
And I think it takes a while for often new players or maybe players who are sort of first dipping their toes into tactics to realize, oh, right, like I get it now. The only thing that you can do to stop the enemy from acting is incapacitate them in some way, right? Some sort of status effect or death. And, you know, usually death is the easiest one if you don't have magic.
Right. And that's just because in D&D, you still get to do everything on your sheet, even if you're at one hit point. Now, there are some monsters that have some goofy, like, edge cases, but, like...
Well, I mean, sometimes they get more dangerous. You know what I mean? Like think Legend of Zelda, right? Like, what you don't want is four enemies, you know, one hit away from death, because then they all move really quickly and they turn red.
Right. The in fourth edition, this was the bloodied mechanic, right?
Right, it's exactly. Like, sometimes they got stronger.
Right. You don't want to bloody everything. You want to bloody one thing and see how bad it is.
Right.
Also, notably, this is not how things like Savage Worlds work, mm-hmm. right? This isn't how Blades in the Dark works. They have a death spiral. So once you start accumulating damage, your options are decreased. Your performance is decreased. You start spiraling until you're eventually severely impeded. And your ability to act is naturally so low that you can kind of be ignored, right? And you, in this case, could be an enemy as well.
And now it's interesting to note here that, you know, in games like Savage Worlds and Blades in the Dark, where you do have this really difficult death spiral to contend with, that doesn't mean you don't focus fire. Because remember, at the beginning, we sort of defined focus fire not as necessarily everyone attacks the same target, but everyone attacks in a coordinated way to eliminate the most dangerous targets first.
Right.
So once you bring the death spiral into effect, if a character is incapacitated enough where they're not really a threat, then you can ignore them. You then shift to the targets who are the next most capable.
Exactly.
So sometimes in some games, it actually is better to, like, you know, put a slug in this person's chest and then an RPG in the back corner, right? Because if that takes them out, even if it doesn't kill them, in the mechanics of this game, you've effectively done the same thing.
Right, exactly. You have done the maximum damage to their next turn.
Right, exactly. You've reduced their action economy by the maximum amount.
Another assumption of the smart team, dumb team example is that they don't have any competing priorities, right? Their only option is to attack. They don't have any crowd control. They don't have any dodging. They don't have any defense. They don't have any chance of failure, right? They don't have any way of gaining action economy advantage or suffering disadvantage. They can only attack.
They don't miss.
Yeah. Right. You know, every time you add one of those elements into your, like, decision tree, right, like, it becomes more complicated in how to focus fire and where to focus fire.
Keep all these things in mind. Like, think of the scenarios you've all probably seen where, you know, even if you hadn't coordinated this, you probably have had a period where, you know, two people at least were like, okay, let's both attack this person, right? And then the first person takes them out. And now suddenly you're like, whoa, hold on. Let's reevaluate all of this and, like, what the threat level is here and, like, who we're attacking and how.
Well, speaking of, the other assumption here is that both teams were equally dangerous, right? Like, every enemy was identical. There was no priority target.
Right. No mage to geek.
Right. As long as they choose the same target, they get the right effect. And then the last assumption is one that often I think it's overlooked by groups, is that the damage was efficient, right? It was, you know, one damage at a time and one hit point at a time. So there was no risk of wasting damage on a dead target. And we could talk about this a little bit later, but, like, basically the idea here is, like, you know, if you drop a fireball on somebody's head who's at one hit point, it doesn't matter how many d6 you roll for damage, like, they're dead either way, right? So you probably could have done something differently. You don't have to enter that calculus in when everyone's doing the same thing.
Yeah, you'll often hear us talk about this kind of thing when we're sort of theory crafting or dealing with very large numbers. You know, at the point where in certain games you get where one attack will take out another enemy from, you know, full to dead, there's no point in doing more damage. There's no point in like figuring out ways. Like the opportunity cost of doing even more damage on top of that is wasted. And you know, you'll see us talk about this with like, you know, 5e paladin builds where it's like, I don't know, an extra 48 damage is probably often going to be wasted. You know, right. Like do something else, defend an ally or something like that.
Or there's like, that happens a lot with healing in 5th edition too. I know it's a little bit the inverse, but it's like chip healing is not very helpful, right? The odds of 3 extra hit points making a difference, not great, right?
Right.
Especially if you're, you know, at 37 hit points or 40 hit points, like what's the difference?
Right. And then, you know, also the best action economy for healing is mass healing, but of course if not everyone is damaged, then you're completely wasting it, right? Or if someone's only mildly damaged because you can't gain more HP than your maximum.
Right, but now we're digressing on efficiency.
It's true. All right, so how do you apply focus firing?
Well, it's pretty simple. You choose a target, you focus on that target, and then you choose the next target and you focus on that target.
It's like eating cupcakes.
Yeah, or donuts.
Yeah, like you pick a donut, you eat that donut until it's gone, and then you pick another donut.
Or it's like eating cupcakes, in which you pick the cupcake, you lick all the frosting off until it sucks, and then you go to the next cupcake.
You put it back.
If you're a monster.
You pick up a slice of pizza, you fold it in half, you take a bite out of the middle, you put it back, and people wonder, how do they do that? Now, of course, this means that you need to make a decision on which is the best target. Best is super subjective in a lot of scenarios.
Best is often the difference between good tactics and great tactics, right? Applying focused fire to the right target is the art, right? The act of focusing fire is the science.
Right. I mean, the saying isn't geek anyone, geek someone. You know, geek the first person through the door. It's geek the mage, because they're usually the most dangerous and also the most
the squishiest.
Frail. Yeah.
Right.
You know, imagine your typical scenario of bursting through the door and the cult is in the middle of their horrible ritual. There's usually like the cult leader who's the big boss, and you know this is the BBEG and that's the person we have to kill. And like after we do that, all this is over. Focusing fire on the BBEG is actually not always, or maybe even often, the optimal tactic, mainly because they probably have the most defenses.
Yeah, if you spend, you know, 4 turns trying to whittle them down while you're getting wailed on by the cultist with their, you know, ritual knives, you're going to be wondering, well, maybe taking those extra 5 attacks per round is not the ideal way to handle this situation. I wouldn't have so many holes in me and look like a pincushion.
Yeah, but, you know, if we all focus on one cultist, which in the fiction or even like at first glance looking at the table and the size of the minis might look like a bad idea because this person isn't actually a threat, well, maybe it takes 3 of us to take each of these out, so let's pile on, and before they can even act, the team evil is already down to 4.
Anytime that a target looks like you can focus them down before they get to act, whether that's act first or act next, that's generally a target worth considering. Right. It's not always the case, but like that's generally a good place to start looking for who should you focus on. And then again, keep in mind you don't need to kill targets, right? Disabling them, degrading their performance so they're no longer a threat, you know, in those death spiral systems, throwing them into the death spiral. Like often that's good enough to require a switch of target. And recognizing, right, when you have crossed that line for a given target, right? When you pepper them with 6 bullet wounds, but the 7th will kill them. I'm not too worried about somebody who's got 6 holes in them, you know? That's maybe a good time to think about switching.
Right. And this is why we often talk about battlefield removal abilities, which just, you know, send someone away, even for a temporary amount of time. It means that, you know, in the, you know, 10 seconds that we're actually going to spend in the fiction in this fight, we'll take care of everyone else. And then when they come back, maybe we'll parlay.
Right.
You can also do this not just by like punching or shooting or stabbing, right? Like focus firing can also mean, all right, these people will go punch and stab. And if I can tell that we're up against a pyromancer, if I can cast, you know, resist elements or protection from fire or something like that on our melee combatant, I have done an excellent job in eliminating much of the threat of the pyromancer.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, this is, you know, we talk about focusing fire as generally doing the firing. But sometimes it is about like making sure that you're around to attack longer, right? And looking, you know, a round or two in advance and kind of estimating what's going to be happening to you and mitigating some of that so you know you're there at the end of the fight.
Right. Because if you keep in mind, like, eyes on the prize of hurting their action economy, now the pyromancer is casting spells and doing less damage. They're getting less bang for each action that they're able to take, which, you know, in the math ends up being very similar to not being able to take those actions.
Yeah, or, you know, degrading them by half, right? Like if you're applying resistance to their only damage type, like they're now half as effective. Like that's the death spiral. Like they've entered the death spiral without taking a bit of damage.
Or, you know, you force them into making suboptimal choices for their particular build or stat block where, you know, maybe they're smart enough to realize fire damage isn't going to do it anymore. Well, I have some crappy spells that don't do fire, or, you know, I have a dagger. Let me whip it out and see what happens.
Of course, like all tactics, it's useful when it's useful and it's not useful when it's not. So let's talk about when are some times you want to abandon focus fire tactics.
When the barbarian rages. Should we maybe shoot the attack? Nope, nope. This person's closer to me and I don't like their face. So I'm going to rip it off.
Yeah, well, I guess peel is one case. Yes. If you have an angry barbarian in your face, it's probably a good idea to shoot the angry barbarian and not whatever you thought you were going to do, lest you not live to see the next round.
Of course, this could also just be an opportunity for the barbarian to make the selection on who we are all going to focus fire on.
Right. Well, when it's a friendly barbarian, yes.
Right, yeah, yeah. Oh, you stab that guy. All right, I mean, everyone stab that guy. Yeah, that sounds good.
I think that does touch on something, right? When the coordination doesn't make sense, though, right? Like, when everybody is talking about, like, precise tactics and the barbarian is in a blood rage, you know, when you're activating your Sekhmet in Lancer, like... That coordination doesn't make any sense anymore, right? So that's fine. Like, let the barbarian just go hit the biggest thing he can find, or the angriest, or the nearest thing, or the thing that's most covered in blood, right? Like, whatever decision tree that a character makes, fine. You know, and then likewise, like, maybe the PCs don't have a way of communicating to each other, right? So coordination is difficult because of that, or they can't see each other well, or they can't all see the same targets. So there's something that's going on that makes it more difficult to focus, and maybe they don't get the sense that they need to yet.
I think this is an important point when we're talking about optimal tactics, because I think often groups at a table will get into a groove where, you know, there are a few people who are tactically minded and they've basically come up with, you know, attack patterns, you know, or are directing other people, or someone's playing the warlord or whatever, right? And so we know that in a given scenario, these are the best tactics for this particular group. But then you get into a situation, like you said, where maybe you can't see things, or you don't have information, or you can't communicate, or you're separated, or the party is split, or it's dark, or whatever. And now suddenly everyone is in a scenario where you need to do the single thing that is best for your own character. And these are situations where a less experienced group would probably have fewer issues, because that's kind of what they're always doing, is I'm thinking for myself and trying to, you know, do the best thing that my character would do, or try to use my abilities to, you know, the best that I can. But if you have been relying on group tactics and, you know, things like focus firing, and now that's yanked away from you suddenly because of, you know, something that the GM planned for, then you might find yourself flailing a bit without sort of that feedback. Like we talked about before, another reason why you don't want to focus fire, or maybe don't want to focus fire anymore, is when you're worried about overshooting a damage target or applying overkill to a particular target. Wargamers know all about this, right? The enemy has 5 hit points, and if you hit them with the fireball, they are absolutely dead. But you just wasted all of that damage, and you wasted the ability to use that area of attack effect another time when it would be more effective.
Right, and this applies to, you know, special weapons, special ammunition, you know, activated abilities on your weapons, whatever they are, right? Like, you don't want to go all in on a target who's going to die no matter what. And likewise, like, if somebody, you know, if you have an enemy who is down to a minimal number of hit points, maybe it makes sense for you, like the big bursty paladin, to go fight the next priority target, knowing that, you know, that wounded enemy could be cleaned up by somebody else.
Right, knowing that none of your 68 smite damage is going to be wasted on this target, which is going to be dead, and then, you know, the piddly bard has to stab the next big enemy with a rapier.
The wild part about that is I'm not sure if you said 68 or 6d8, and either one could be accurate for a paladin.
Yeah, either one. Let me just throw this in here. A corollary to this is a good GM tactic is hold things behind the screen if it makes for a better story. So if someone does crit or the paladin does say, like, you know what, I'm going to go all out. I think this is a really tough enemy. Let's drop the biggest smite that I've got. And then the enemy had 4 hit points left. Like, play it up as like really big and cool. And they'll be like, well, huh, that was a waste. Sucks to be you.
Yeah.
it would have died, whatever. No, like if they scoop up all their dice, like, don't say it doesn't matter, they're dead anyway. Let them roll the dice.
Right. Another time to consider abandoning focus fire is when you do have strong crowd control. You know, if you can reduce the effectiveness or deny actions to lots of targets, it's often worth spreading those out rather than focusing on a single target.
Yeah, mages in general, controller characters in general. It either might not make sense to focus fire along with the rest of the group, or, you know, you might set the stage for everyone else to then make decisions about who to focus fire on. Basically, who succeeded on these saves, who isn't trapped, you know, inside the nets or the smoke bombs.
And then last, I think it's important to abandon this when you're the GM.
Yeah. And
I recognize this is a slippery slope because you don't want to, you know, have combat encounters that are brain dead enemies at all times. But I mean, targeting a single PC is the tactically wise choice almost always, but that doesn't make it fun for the player. In two ways. One, if you're, you know, the tank who wants to be a big pool of hit points and, you know, collect all the damage, that means you're constantly interacting with that player and not with the other players at the table. So they're not doing anything. Like, they're just watching at that point as you are, you know, feeding damage into the tank who expects it. So in that case, it's good to spread the damage around just to keep people active. And then the other sense is when you know, focus down like the mage, right? When you as the GM geek the mage, a lot of times the PC falls pretty quickly when you focus all of the enemy abilities on them. And now, like, they're dead, they're out of the fight, they've lost a character. And what do you have to show for it, right? Like, all you proved was that you could bring a lot of enemies to a fight and then send them all at the same target. What were they supposed to do here?
Right. Remember that the point of focus firing is to reduce enemy actions. But remember that when the enemy is the players, actions are playing the game. You know, if the players don't get actions, they're not doing anything. They are bored.
Right.
And, you know, damage, being attacked, having to make saving throws, having to dodge, having to activate your defenses, that's spotlight. Those are the interesting, fun things. Like, that's using your abilities. And even if you have players complaining about, like, oh, I'm getting attacked again, the same player may not realize it, but they would be probably more upset if they were never getting attacked.
So let's talk about, as GMs, how do we design encounters around focus fire tactics?
Well, you can incorporate multiple threats with different profiles in the enemy lineup. So you can have glass cannons who would be very easy to take down, and if they're not taken out very quickly, deal a ton of damage. You can have swarms who usually are very resistant to damage or hard to target or something like that, and so very difficult to focus fire.
Yeah, and then you might have like elites, right, who are sort of that balance of hardy and also dealing heavy damage, the kind of thing you can't ignore forever, but might not be your first priority, right? And then they have to ask the question of, at what point do we have to start focusing on this before it gets out of hand?
Yeah, and you can see it, with these multiple profiles, the goal here is not only to proof your encounter against focus fire tactics, it's also to reward them. You want to reward good tactics and make that interesting and fun. So if you have multiple glass cannon enemies, the focus fire tactic is most effective against these. The best thing to do is to take out a glass cannon before it can fire its cannon.
Right.
give them that, you know? But, you know, have several of them so that you actually do get to fire off one of those cannons. And then they get the reward of seeing what they prevented when they killed the first one.
Right. And I think that's important. Like, you know, having glass cannons that only explode, right, and never actually get to fire, in a lot of ways, like, that becomes a diminishing return in the sense of, like, the feel good of winning, right? Because, like, until you really know what that threat level is, right, like, when you get hit by something that smacks you for 50 damage in a go, right, and you think, oh my god, 2 levels ago that would have killed me, like, and now I'm just, you know, I'm here on 10 hit points and struggling, right? Like, that validates all the times that you focused on those glass cannons in the past, right? And it reminds you in the future, like, oh yeah, we got to deal with that thing, right? So that experience sticks with you. It's important that, like, they have a chance to reiterate why they should be prioritized.
Yeah, and then on the flip side of that, those sort of middle ground elites really can stymie this tactic because, you know, they're not dangerous enough that we definitely need to kill them fast, but also they're not squishy enough that we definitely know that we can take them out quickly. So, you know, you'll often have a scenario where players will disagree about who to focus fire on. And that actually is a great thing for table dynamics because now people are having a conversation.
Right. Yeah, this happens a lot, I think, when you have a couple of these kind of hard-hitting, hardier enemies, and they are putting multiple PCs at risk, right? When multiple people are one or two hits away, now you're also having... It's not just about the enemy that you're trying to decide what to do. You're thinking about who on our team are we willing to sacrifice, right? Who can we most mitigate getting knocked out? Right? Who can we survive the rest of this encounter without their services, right? Or who can we most easily get to revive, right?
And then in addition to mixing up the enemies that you place on the board, you can also include crowd control or you know, interesting terrain features. You can position the enemies or have them act in a way that makes it expensive in terms of action or ability to focus. So it might be obvious who the mage is and where they are, but, you know, if they're located 100 feet away and you're dealing with a mostly melee party, focusing fire is pretty infeasible.
Yeah.
Something as simple as, like, there's a stream in the way can cause a lot of problems.
Yeah, you can't get your charge attack off if there's a stream in the way. This can also, like, when we say crowd control, right, like, this doesn't have to be special abilities. This can be as simple as just engaging PCs in melee, right, to where they can no longer just reposition at will. If you swamp them with a bunch of, you know, minions, they have to deal with those minions, or every time they move, they risk getting popped by, you know, an opportunity attack or whatever.
Right. Remember, this isn't about making it impossible. It's about making it expensive. So, right. Sure, you throw out lots of, you know, tiny brownies or whatever with, you know, big sharp butcher knives, and it makes it difficult to run through the tall grass. If the player still wants to run through tall grass, that's fine. You're just going to take a few butcher knives to the thighs. But they have paid for it. They have now earned it. And, okay, they can run across to the other side and try to geek that mage.
And so when you're doing this, right, like the general rule, you want to engage range PCs with melee elites, right? So big, tough, difficult melee opponents are a challenge for like the bow wielder, right, or the sniper to try and escape and kite away from. It makes it very hard for them to choose the efficient target because they've got somebody screaming in their face and, you know, trying to hack their arms off with a chainsaw.
On the flip side, engage your heavy hitters with chaff, with minions, with enemies that will die easily, but where there are a lot of them, because it increases the odds of overkilling. It increases the chance that they're going to waste their damage and or will hold back because they don't want to use abilities that will waste damage.
And then use your own crowd control, like actual crowd control abilities, to minimize repositioning, right? So if you cannot move effectively on the battlefield to, you know, get to that hidden target or get behind the terrain or get the flanking angle on the priority target, you're likely to be forced to choose a suboptimal target. Either you focus a different one or, you know, one or two characters end up not able to attack the main target and they have to make a different decision, right? You're not punishing them. You are providing them like tactical variability, right? An additional set of choices that they need to make and better manage.
Right. This is a really important thing to keep in mind when you're creating these kinds of encounters. It's about challenging the players. It's about giving them interesting additional options and combat tactics to think about. What you don't want to do is, take the melee elite and have them pop up stealthily behind the archer while at the same time, all those brownies sprout up around your melee combatants. Like you don't want to hard counter your players' abilities. It is usually better to, present those enemies with those abilities on the field and give your players the option to decide how they're going to engage. So, the ranged combatant says, oh, okay, I'd better stay away from the melee elite. That might be difficult, but it shouldn't be impossible. You shouldn't be making the decisions for them.
Right.
All the time. Sometimes a melee elite stealths up behind you and, that's those are the breaks.
And that's it too, right? Is that player characters are repeat customers, right? So this is, it's not about a single fight using every tactic. It's about over time introducing multiple tactics, right? It's about like, well, in this fight, you got countered and didn't get to do the thing that you usually do. And so that was interesting for you. But next fight, you can go back to doing your bread and butter, right? Like if that's what you enjoy, like that's fine. I'll plan around that instead.
And then another easy thing you can do is, if it makes sense tactically for the enemies to focus fire, then have them do it, but have them stop doing it earlier than player characters would.
Right. So don't shoot to completion, right? Don't drop somebody to zero. Put the fear of God in them and then let the other enemies do the same thing to another PC.
Right. Make your point and then make it again to someone who's still alive.
Exactly. Because just killing somebody first is probably going to result in a bad play experience. Putting two people on the brink of death. Well, now you have our attention, right? Like now we have a real problem to solve here. And more importantly, we have a fair opportunity to do it. Okay. So let's talk a little bit for storytellers. How do we incorporate focus fire tactics into fiction?
Yeah, because I think one issue that comes up, especially with new groups, is focus firing is often at odds with the way that movies or comic books portray these kinds of scenes. Heroes are almost always pairing off in single combat, often against somebody who has, their exact same abilities because this is my arch enemy, or someone who has the opposite abilities and you're perfectly suited to dealing with, or perhaps completely not suited to dealing with.
Yes. There's nothing but mirror matches and hard counters.
But, when like Batman and Robin show up and are fighting the Joker and Harley, Batman and Robin, for some reason, even though they're supposed to be like brilliant tacticians, don't go, let's take out Harley first, right? Obviously.
The glass cannon.
Right. Yeah. Oh, she has that giant mallet. Okay. Let's drop to range, take her out with batarangs, and then make sure you don't get close enough to Joker for him to use his acid flower. What's the problem? Instead, it's, oh, the Batman says I'll take on Joker, and now the Boy Wonder has to tackle Harley Quinn alone.
You know, it's unlikely that PCs are necessarily going to continue to opt for that strategy, right? It might happen once or twice, and then people kind of figure it out. So I think one way that you can encourage this, right, to make your fights flow a little less, like, tactically and a little more narratively like that, is to just challenge the PCs directly, right? Like, a challenge of honor, a challenge to a duel, right? Like, if there are witnesses and that's important to the character, they'll honor it, right? Like, the Paladin is going to turn down a duel, certainly not with, like, a vampire.
There can be some above-the-table prodding as well. I remember in some games that I've played with new players, there's this sense that you don't want to steal someone else's kill, that you don't want to step on someone else's toes at the table. So, you know, this person has attacked enemy A. I won't attack enemy A. That's your enemy, right? And if that is the etiquette at your table, that's something that can, you know, easily be handled by saying, like, no, I mean, like, you all share the XP. Like, it doesn't matter who gets the final kill. It doesn't, you know, that's not the way that this game works. And so, like, feel free to jump in together. Like, you're a team.
I think going back to when focus fire tactics are implemented at the table effectively, right, you can use those moments to highlight the PC's efficiency as you're narrating, right? So they're an ace combat team that's operating at a high level as they're focusing targets and breezing through this difficult combat, right? Like, that's a triumphant moment. That isn't, like, that cakewalk of a fight isn't that you underestimated the encounter. It's that they are just that good, right? Like, these PCs are trained killers.
Yeah, alternatively, you can highlight what was about to happen had they not been so tactically successful. Like, oh, wow, they were just about to use their impressive ability. You won't see that, but, you know, maybe it'll come up later.
Yeah, the retrospective, like, oh, man, if they had gone one more round.
Right.
That alarm would have gone off. What alarm? Yeah, exactly.
This is a time when it's great to be a fan of the party. We talk a lot about, you know, you want to avoid being an antagonistic GM, but you don't have to be on the party's side, right? But you can cheer for them. You can like take part in their triumphs and applaud them and be really happy when those things happen because it's a cool moment at the table. And that is going to reinforce like clever tactics.
Yeah, and then I think another technique to lean on narratively is to allow for either recon or flashback planning, right? So if you are struggling in the narrative with how the party is so efficient and so focused, right, and moving so tactically, like, let that be, you know, a flashback. Like, we knew that the big bad was going to be summoning waves of zombies, so, you know, the players have discovered the way that they're going to deal with it. Now we flashback to see the player characters discussing how they're going to deal with it. Right. And that way the PCs are simply executing the brilliant plan rather than, you know, being the puppets of the all-knowing players.
So if you're having trouble wrapping your head around why these characters, you know, with this particular backstory and in this particular scenario would use a brutally efficient tactic, consider that maybe they want to win. Maybe they don't want to die. A GM needs to present them with reasons why they do want to get this over with quickly. There are a lot of reasons that you would want to focus fire, and there are a lot of reasons in the fiction where it would make sense. And I think, you know, if this is something that you're not doing at the table, you should try it out and see how you like it. I think a common complaint at a lot of tables is that combat takes too long. Storytellers, do you want to make your combat shorter? Do you want to get back to the RP and sitting around the campfire and doing the dinner parties? Focus fire. Take out the mage.
Perfect. Do you hear that, Ishan?
Nope. I was shot 4 times before my first turn, and now I can't hear anything.
Well, then it's time to move on to the Character Creation Forge. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes.
All right, so this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building Fire in the Hole. Shane, what is that?
It's a guy who digs holes and drops fire in them.
I kind of love it. What's the build?
The build is a gnome, moon druid 2, draconic sorcerer 18.
A classic combination.
As you do. So we will take the Mark of Scribing gnome from the Eberron sourcebook.
An Eberronian gnome druid.
Yeah.
Dragon sorcerer. All right. Uh-huh. Yep.
Yep. So this will add a handful of spells to your spell list, since the Mark of Scribing is all about communication. They're not super relevant here. I don't know. There's silence. That's a fun one if you're sneaking through into these holes. But otherwise, there's a lot of, like, you know, message and those types of spells on that list. But more importantly, you will gain the +1 to charisma if you are playing by those rules. It is the best gnome for this build. Then from Moon Druid, we'll take 2 levels first. We'll get spellcasting, which will, of course, give us level 1 druid spells, which are fine. But we're just maintaining our full spell progression. We don't sacrifice any spell slots. And then at level 2, we'll get Wild Shape. With our Moon Druid feature, we will get up to CR1. You will not be permitted a flying or swimming speed, but there's no restriction on burrowing. So
I applaud this loophole.
Yes, you'll have plenty of options at CR1. And then, of course, you'll also gain Combat Wild Shape, which allows you to enter your Wild Shape as a bonus action. You can exit Wild Shape as a bonus action at any time.
I've definitely been in scenarios where the Combat Wild Shape comes in extremely handy, right? Like, it's a bonus action, turn into a burrowing creature, and then you have your full burrowing speed. And it doesn't matter if it's 20 feet, who can follow you?
Right. Or the reverse. You say fire in the hole, you lob a fireball, and then you wild shape and burrow underground to hide from the results.
All right, then 18 levels of Dragon Sorcerer. Are you taking them in this order?
Yeah, I am. I think you need the Combat Wild Shape to, like, to really fit the theme. So I would just take that first and then just burn straight through the Draconic Sorcerer
take
levels.
Produce Flame so that you've got the fire and the hole, and then you can deal with Dragon Sorcerer.
Problem solved.
So Draconic Origin, you're going to choose red or gold for fire damage. You'll get Draconic Resilience and an extra HP per level, bump to your unarmored AC. And then level 3, you get Meta Magic. You'll end up with 4 of them total. Shane, what are the good options?
So the required option is Transmuted Spell from Tasha's Cauldron of Everything. So this is the one that allows you to convert damage from one element to another. Naturally, this is great for dodging resistances, right? The forever bane of the fire mage is that fire is the most resistant damage type. So what do? Well, you transmute the spell, you turn it into cold damage, you move on with your day. But in this case, as a draconic sorcerer, you can also turn things unexpectedly into fire damage so that more spells in your spell list are potential fire in the hole candidates. Then you'll also want to consider, you'll get 3 of Heightened Spell, which is disadvantage to saves, Empowered Spell, which lets you reroll Charisma dice, Charisma modifier number of dice in a damage roll. And then Twin Spell and Quicken Spell are kind of the 2 staples of the Sorcerer. I think Quicken Spell is great when you're not planning on wild shaping, but it kind of competes for that bonus action, so it's not always great. Twin spell, of course, is just double the efficiency. Wonderful if you can cast two concentration spells with it and then turn into a burrowing animal and go hide. Stuff like that.
Then at 6, you get elemental affinity. You'll add your charisma modifier to a fire damage roll, and you can spend a sorcery point for resistance to fire. So remember, if you use transmuted spell to turn a spell into fire damage, you'll get the additional bonus damage.
Now, I am too far removed from my rules mastery here, Ishin, but at level 14, we get dragon wings, mm-hmm. which we can trigger as a bonus action. Mm-hmm. I am unclear if you have dragon wings when you wild shape. Do your magical dragon wings come with you? I'm not sure.
Are they listed as spectral dragon wings?
They're like, not spectral. That's what's weird about
like
this.
Real
one.
Wings that grow out of your back and they stay there forever. Is that it?
They can. Yes, they don't. They don't like you. You know, you can remove them by choice, but they stay indefinitely.
Oh, if you can turn them right. If you can turn them on and off, then. I don't know, should I actually look this thing up? Because I think my ruling is if you have wings out and you turn into a creature with no wings, you lose wings. But if you spend another bonus action after that while you are that creature, you grow wings.
But I think because you don't keep all those actions in wild shape, do you?
You do.
Oh, well then great.
Keep all your abilities, yeah.
Oh, well, perfect. I'm also... of the opinion that you can use combat wild shape or you can use old fashioned wild shape. So for a for an action and a bonus action, you could be a flying whatever you want to be.
Badger. I mean, it's always going to be a badger.
I mean,
giant badger.
Correct.
I want to be CR1 quarter, not zero.
And then at level 18, you'll get Draconic Presence, which as an action and for 5 of your spell points, you can create a 60-foot aura around you that forces a wisdom save for everyone in the aura versus either being charmed or frightened, your choice, for 1 minute. This is a different kind of bomb, but I would argue no less effective of a bomb, and thus it fits fire in the hole.
What if I call this Badger Magnificence, and I only do it in giant badger form? And then people are charmed or frightened, but also very confused as to why this badger is so terrifying or alluring.
I mean, it's obvious why he's so terrifying.
And alluring.
Perhaps not alluring. It's obvious why he's so terrifying. He's a badger.
Look at my fine stripes. These sharp claws.
So before we wrap up, we want to take another moment and thank our Patreon supporters.
Yes, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. And supporters of any level get access to our plot hook of the week bonus content, which is available right now on patreon.com. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all of our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
And what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about... Did you get that? I tried to send it to you telepathically. We're talking about telepathy.
Ah, yes. Well, I got it, but I don't know how that works across podcasts, so it's good that you clarified.
The word telepathy that popped into your brains, like, you know, 4 days ago, that was me sending this.
Makes sense.
Sorry.
Yeah. It's weird how, like, when I read a word on a page, it pops into my brain. Do you think, like, the page has telepathy too, or?
It's the author working through the page. It is the wonder of literature.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building the Dragon Rider of Pern.
Well, that's it for episode 291 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishin. Thanks for listening.